don't know if they are.
That'd be odd, huh? Unless they're hiding.
Right.
He is here. Oh, there's he.
I know, I'm not.
I should be digging. I'd rather be digging.
I mean, not a religious thing.
Sit on?
Good afternoon. This meeting of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. Before we take up our two bills, I want to mention we have at least two new staff. Crystal Fitchett is the new committee legislative assistant, and also Tamara Shevlin is our committee page. I think otherwise it's pretty much the same. This is our first hearing, so we're eager to get started on this, and the first bill we're going to take up is Senator Betzold's bill, Senate File 1024. So welcome. I know you got a committee to chair, so I'm sorry we started late.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that was brought to me last year by mental health advocates, and actually Section 1 of the bill is not to be needed. If you have a quorum yet, that can be deleted as an oral author's amendment.
We do have a quorum. Senator Hand moves to delete Section 1 of the bill. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill really reflects what is current practice, but the language of the statute doesn't quite reflect that. This deals with civil commitment proceedings, and, of course, a number of years ago, people were they were sent to a state hospital or regional treatment center. And over the years, we started having more and more community placement facilities available. With the closing down of some of the regional treatment centers, now we have about a number of these 16-bed programs throughout the state. I believe there's about 9 of these 16-bed programs, which are operated by the commissioner and actually serve as community-based programs. So basically what this does is it dovetails with what is current practice by DHS, saying that a court can commit a person to a community hospital, which would include the behavioral health hospital operated by the Commissioner of Human Services. As I'm told by DHS, that's what they actually do now. They don't have anybody available to come today because I think they probably have more important things to do than worry about my bill. But I'm not aware of any problems or opposition with the bill. Mr. Connolly is here to offer any background and testimony if you wish, Mr. Chair.
Briefly, Mr. Connolly, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Connolly with the Consumer Survivor Network, and actually Sue Abderholden found out that Baltimore can't get their airplanes running unless they have at least 3 days post-snow. So she would have been home yesterday and here today except for that dilemma. But this is a bill that originated with the National Alliance for Mental Ill in Minnesota, and it was really seeking clarification that for community commitments, that smaller hospitals the state operates could be utilized, and it was not clear in some judges' minds, even though the department agrees with this language. The Mental Health Legislative Network did review this language last year, and I know of no opposition to it. Thank you.
I'll move the bill for Senator Betzold.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1024 as amended be recommended pass, and this goes to Judiciary?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on that motion. Is there anybody who has wished to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Senator Coring, are you going to be around for a while?
Yeah.
Can you chair?
I can. Welcome to your own committee, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
The vote was so loud on that last one with only three members sitting at the table. I wondered where, and then I saw they were all in the back tier with lunch.
The lunch
group.
Yes. Senator Marty, you've got Senate File 1631 before the committee. Do we have any amendments?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A3 delete everything amendment, which I think is in the packet.
Yes, it is. Okay, members, we've got the A3 amendment. Senator Marty has offered. I believe this would be an author's amendment, wouldn't it, Senator Marty? All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. So now on Senate File 1631 as amended.
Thank
Senator
you,
Marty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll give a little bit of background of this first and how it came about. This is an issue that's generated a lot of controversy. It's a medical issue and one that I don't pretend to be an expert in or anything, but it deals with Lyme disease and the treatments and therapies and so on for people who have had ongoing problems with it. And Lyme disease, you will find out, I think in your packets there's a little flyer that talks about the number of people in Minnesota who have had it. It's a growing problem, and you can see there's a chart that shows how many people, both in cases, the incidence number per 100,000 people, and also the number of cases. And it's been growing significantly, and there's a lot of question of whether it's always identified. I first came across this issue a number of years ago when a woman who, actually a former regent at the university, had had something, and she had been out for a number of years, and was, I found out later, I saw her back in action again at one point, and she said she had been out with some Lyme disease that had not been diagnosed for a long time, and she was on a long-term therapy for it. I didn't know there was any controversy about it at the time, but Senator Vanderveer and some of his constituents approached me a couple of years ago because they were having, a lot of doctors were expressing concerns that they felt pressure, Board of Medical Practice, that if you do certain types of therapies for this, that you might be at risk of losing your licensure. And the Board of Medical Practice says, we have not had any cases of this, and they don't expect it to happen lightly, but been watching this for the last several years, and there have been some doctors in some states sanctioned for this. And there is a medical controversy over this. One side has said that there is an appropriate protocol which does not call for, and there are medical guidelines at times, and there, in this case, there are medical guidelines that call for not using long-term antibiotic therapy. They believe that this is a treated one time and that other things may not be Lyme disease, but it's something else. And this is to show you the scope of this. There are at least three states, I think, that have passed legislation like this. Connecticut, where the city of Lyme, where Lyme disease was first discovered, city of Connecticut, the state legislature in Connecticut unanimously passed legislation very similar to this. And all the legislation does is to say that the Board of Medical Practice shall not, subdivision 2, you can see, shall not impose disciplinary action against a physician solely on the basis of prescribing, administering, or dispensing long-term antibiotic therapy to a patient who's been clinically diagnosed with chronic Lyme disease. It makes it clear we're not taking away their authority in anything else. And lots of the concern I've heard is, well, first of all, we don't want to legislate medical therapy, and this bill does not legislate or mandate or even recommend a certain therapy. It does say that we don't want the board to step in on something when, based on one set of guidelines, when there's a clear division in the community. And when I met with some of the people from Minnesota Medical Association and so on who have concerns about this bill, quoted in the opponents of the bill tend to quote several studies, NIH studies and so on. And the author of one of those quoted studies, I'm just going to read you a brief thing. I think it may be in your packet. This is Dr. Brian Fallon from, I think he's from Columbia, and I'm sorry I don't have the citation with me or anything right here, but he's speaking to the Infectious Disease Society of America, which had put out the guidelines, and then they were reviewing them again this year because Connecticut Attorney General complained about conflict of interest, and in a settlement they agreed to review the guidelines. And Dr. Fallon was the author of one of these studies. He was testifying. He says, one particular aspect of the guidelines that I wish to address is the statement that antibiotic therapy has not proven to be useful and is not recommended for patients with chronic subjective symptoms after recommended treatment. I think the statement is partially correct and partially incorrect. And the part of it that's incorrect is where it says antibiotic therapy has not proven to be useful. The part that is correct is that the control trials did end up concluding antibiotic therapy is not recommended. So what does that mean? It means there's a difference between efficacy usefulness versus what's clinically recommended. Efficacy was definitively demonstrated in the Stony Brook fatigue study done by Lauren Krupp, and she found the percentage of this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, was this. So I could stop my talk here because here's the evidence that repeated antibiotic therapy is helpful, and this was the subjective symptom of fatigue. But she ended up concluding that repeated treatment was not recommended, particularly in light of the frequency of serious adverse effects. 4 of her patients had serious adverse effects out of 55. So if an antibiotic is effective but carries risks, then what is next? Well, you could look for a different antibiotic with a better safety profile. You could find a way of identifying and advance patients most at risk, et cetera. And so the point is it's not going to be an easy issue, and I think the legislature should be cautious about talking about these issues and stepping in. But at the end, one of the panelists asked Dr. Fallon, thank you, Dr. Fallon. I'll start with the first question, but I want to take questions from other panelists. So if you put yourself in this situation of risk-benefit, which I mean doctor and treating doctor, going back to your slide in which where you said patients with very high impairment had some adverse effects which were very serious, and I turned around and asked you, well, doctor, you know I can't function. My life is on hold. I've lost my job, and you had objective findings. Would you treat? Dr. Fallon, I would definitely recommend treatment. And so I think this is the nature of it. The studies that are being quoted are saying, look, this doesn't in certain ways show that. And I don't care to get into all the medical thing. I just want to say that this is an unusual thing. And it comes down to sort of the theoretical, you know, if the legislature does this here, might we be stepping in and recommending the board or stopping the medical practice board from some other time from some other treatment or something. And I don't think we want to do that. But that's a theoretical issue versus doctors who are using their best medical judgment, clinically analyzing the patients, figuring out that this is the situation they are facing, and then going over the risks, because there are definite risks. And there are, according to some of the authors of these studies, definite benefits. And we have lots of people here today, some of whom have been treated this way, who have seen a positive impact in it. And in Connecticut, the Connecticut State Medical Society, here I'm going to read the testimony from Dr. William Handelman in Connecticut, where, again, the bill did pass unanimously, a very similar bill. We modeled our legislation on theirs. Connecticut State Medical Society would support this legislation. We realize that this is a difficult issue and that there's a large dichotomy of physicians between two groups of physicians who treat this condition. We feel that any physician who's acting in good faith and using appropriate diagnostic criteria and evaluation and treating according to acceptable guidelines should be permitted to practice to his full extent. We also feel physicians should not be prosecuted or be subject to licensure restrictions when they're acting in good faith and treating according to acceptable guidelines. And so the Connecticut Medical Association made the decision that, you know, because we want doctors to use their best judgment, and it's not going to be an easy call all the time, but I think that that's what the issue is here. And with that, I'm happy to take questions, but I think it'd be helpful if we have the testimony from both sides before we go into great detail on the questions.
Well, first of all, Senator Marty, I want to personally thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think this is a bigger problem than anybody even realizes. I had town hall meetings last year in Nisswa, and then we went to Brainerd and went to Crosby with my House member, Representative Ward. And when we got to Nisswa, I said to the group of people that were there, what's the number one issue? And it was Lyme's disease. And we got to Brainerd, and I said, what's the number one issue? And they said, Lyme's disease. And it was a whole different group of people. And I got to Crosby, and it was the same thing. And I went and saw the tape. I'm sure somebody's going to shake their head. There's a tape, and I think it's the Dr. Fallon from Connecticut that's in this movie. And I saw this movie, and I think if our members haven't seen it, we should get that movie for them to see, because there is a huge problem here. So thank you for bringing this bill forward. And so I guess we'll start out right away with the testifiers. We got down. Looks like Dr. Nick LaFond? Is it LaFond?
Yes.
Okay. If you want to step up to the microphone there and state your name for the committee and go ahead and proceed forward with your testimony, sir. Thank you for coming to the committee.
My name is Nicholas LaFond. Infectious disease guidelines, as Senator Marty mentioned, are already in place that are being used, and these guidelines specifically state that late-stage Lyme disease or chronic Lyme disease does not exist and that long-term antibiotics should not be used. These guidelines are being used right now to restrict the treatment of our patients. We are here today to ask the committee to pass legislation that will allow physicians to treat patients with Lyme disease with long-term antibiotics without the fear of being penalized or sanctioned by the Board of Medical Practice. What gives me the right to make this request? I'm a family physician, board certified in family medicine. I've been practicing in Minnesota for 22 years. I've seen over 45,000 patient visits. Some of those patients have Lyme disease, and my wife has been suffering with Lyme disease for the last 10 years. These are my credentials, and I'm happy to have you look at them closer if you desire. This is the legislation before you. To paraphrase, again, this allows physicians like me to prescribe antibiotics for longer than 30 days for patients that are suffering from this devastating chronic Lyme disease without fear of retribution or sanctioning by the Board of Medical Practice. The Board of Medical Practice, let's talk about that. It's a disciplinary board. This is a board that is used to protect the public from bad physicians. Complaints are considered from disciplinary perspectives. Anybody can bring a complaint to the board, and every complaint needs to be investigated. This is obviously a necessary process. This investigative process is confrontational, it's uncomfortable and unpleasant, and it's time-consuming. My malpractice insurance won't cover an investigation by the board. I know of no physician that enjoys being or defending a complaint in front of the Board of Medical Practice. Therefore, even the threat of a board review will make us physicians much more unlikely to prescribe any kind of therapy outside of usual and customary guidelines. Let's look at the guidelines and Lyme disease. Lyme disease is clearly a complex disease. We need further research. We will show you that there is a high incidence of Lyme disease in Minnesota, and that incidence is increasing. Ladies and gentlemen, Lyme disease is a problem in Minnesota. The guidelines state that chronic Lyme disease does not exist. Long-term antibiotics are not necessary. We have real people here behind me that are going to bring real doubt to these statements. These guidelines are impacting us now because they have been used to penalize physicians, to limit the physician's ability to practice medicine, and thereby limit the ability of patients to get the care that they need. So here's the question. If I treat a patient that's suffering from chronic Lyme disease with long-term antibiotics, am I a bad doctor? Do I deserve to be sanctioned? Do I deserve to have my license revoked? These guidelines are doing exactly that. They deny a treatment option for patients who are suffering from this disease. Or, do physicians deserve protection from the Board of Medical Practice to be able to treat patients who are suffering with chronic Lyme disease using any and all options that are available to us. Clearly, we do this with complete informed consent and full disclosure when we're treating patients, just as we would with any other disease process. So this legislation we are proposing does not legislate the medicine that we physicians practice. Instead, it protects us from the disciplinary actions based on the guidelines that might be or that are excessively restrictive, and they're clinically limited. To date, there has been no board action on Minnesota physicians. Let's not begin now. As Senator Marty mentioned, legislation has already been passed. This is not new territory. So in summary, I am asking you to give us physicians the protection and the freedom to be able to treat our patients in a compassionate and competent manner without the fear of disciplinary action. Please pass this legislation.
Any questions? Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, just a couple of questions for clarification for my part. I'm not entirely familiar with the process of the Board of Medical Practices. And you mentioned that there were some usual and customary guidelines that were being applied to different treatment regimens. Who establishes those usual and customary guidelines?
When the board investigates a physician, they will ask expert witnesses to come and give their opinion. They will look at the guidelines that are already in place, and that's where these guidelines for Lyme disease come in.
Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. LaFond, so your answer is that the usual and customary guidelines are things that are established by the Board of Medical Practice in the course of some investigation that might have some controversy attached to it. Is that correct?
Dr. LaFond?
No, Senator. The usual and customary guidelines are those that would be made by the various specialties that are involved.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Doctor, so the usual and customary guidelines are established by a group of doctors who have expertise in a particular regimen of treatment, as I understand your testimony. And so my question then is, the doctors who specialize in the treatment of, and I'm not sure what the general category would be, whether it's internal medicine or infectious disease, I'm not sure, but whoever that group is, why have they not changed their guidelines to be consistent with what you're advocating for?
Dr. LaFond?
That's a good question, and there is a lot of controversy in the treatment of Lyme disease, and that, unfortunately, is the very crux of the problem. And I would rather defer that question to Dr. Maloney, my colleague, who is going to go over that in more detail in her testimony.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doctor. And we'll defer that then. But the second question that I had has to do with the Board of Medical Practices. And I have not been a member of this committee for an excessively long period of time. This is my fourth year on Senator Marty's committee. And I confess a little bit of unfamiliarity with the history of all the things that the Board of Medical Practices does or has done. Are there other examples where we have passed laws to require the Board of Medical Practices to treat a particular treatment in a certain way as this bill would? And I recognize it's not mandating a particular treatment be done, but it is, in effect, stepping in and saying to the Board of Medical Practices, you must not do something. And I'm just wondering, are there other examples where we have done this as a legislature for other treatments? And I can imagine there are many medical treatments that are controversial, and I've heard from people in my years I've been here where there are all kinds of debates about the validity of some sort of treatment or another. But have we ever as a legislature taken this kind of step with other treatments?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'll try and answer that. And I think the answer is no. I don't know that we have done it before. I don't know that any of the states have done this before. That's why there's some controversial about us doing it. But again, in Connecticut, when they looked at it, it passed the legislature unanimously because it was a feeling that What we want is doctors to use good medicine and use their best clinical judgment. And because there is one of the groups has come in with, and they're experts in infectious diseases, they've come in and they've concluded that there is no situation like this. They've said there have been a few doctors, it's been a handful, I think, who have been sanctioned around the country for doing it. But again, as Dr. LaFont said, there's it's intimidating process, and people, we've had many people say, I think in some of the communities, I don't know about Senator Coring's, but I know Senator Vanderveer's district and others, there have been lots of people who have been getting their treatment from other states because it's hard to find a doctor willing to treat it. So it's a question. I don't know that we've ever done this before. And again, I want to stress, we are not mandating they should be doing this. We're not even recommending it. The guy I quoted earlier, who's one of the authors of this study, who it was being used to say we shouldn't do this bill, he was saying, no, he says you got to understand that there's very clearly evidence of the problem and that this has helped, the long-term antibiotics have helped with people, but it's not recommended because that's what the doctor and the patient are supposed to do. We discuss the risks of the treatment and the benefits of the treatment. So I think this is a first here, and I'm sure Connecticut and other states, I would guess, it's the first time they've done it there.
Mr. Chairman, just one last comment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. and Senator Marty. I'm trying to understand this because I guess, frankly, one of the concerns I have is that my bias is to say we ought to let the physicians, through their structures, manage this because they know a lot more than I do about medical treatment. And I'm hesitant in some degree to put into a legislative and political process a statement about medical treatment and that what kind of precedent that may create for other people who have disputes with the medical profession or the whatever the prevailing customary guidelines or the Board of Medical Practices, and then we create a precedent to say, well, there are some ways that we can get around whatever that. Now, it may be that this Board of Medical Practice and the procedure that you're describing, Doctor, are flawed, but that to me seems to be something that the medical profession and the scientists have to manage, and I'm a little hesitant about stepping in this as a legislature when I don't feel like I have great expertise on the medicine here.
Dr. LaFont?
I understand that entirely, and I also have those same kinds of thoughts. However, the problem is not with the Board of Medical Practice. They are simply following through on the standard guidelines that they're given. Our position is that these guidelines are too restrictive and that some patients are not being treated or not getting access to the treatment that they really need. And the fear of being investigated by the board is enough to make a physician say, I'm sorry, I don't want to treat you. And therefore, the patients won't get the treatment that they could, that could very well benefit them. And so until we physicians and medical community can get our act in order, and until we can really understand the specifics of this disease, what we're asking for is that the legislature give us some protection so that we won't get reprimanded or even have the threat of being reprimanded solely for prescribing long-term antibiotics.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hand, in my time in the legislature, we've had two instances when we've gone beyond this where we have mandated treatment. For instance, at a point in women's breast cancer that they have bone marrow transplants, and then we've rescinded it because it was proven not to be effective. And then another time when we mandated treatment for uterine cancer, and 2 years later we rescinded it because it was not good science. And I'm concerned that we get out ahead of ourselves again in a situation here. You said that there are people that are not getting the treatment they need because they fear that the doctor will not treat them because he or she fears reprimand by the board. But generally, medical treatment is mandated by scientific evidence. And so the research generally has to build up to show what is the appropriate line of treatment. And generally, the board will adopt the practice that is in line with the research that is out there.
Senator Marty.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up with both Senator Hand and also with Senator Pretner Solon's comments. And I share Senator Hand's hesitation to step into this. And Senator Pretner Solon, this is different from those cases where the legislature was stepping in and mandating treatment or mandating coverage for treatment and so on. This is a case where we're saying you cannot sanction a doctor for using their best clinical judgment in this case because there has been a set of guidelines that have been stepped in that many people would say are not ready for prime time. And when I quote this Dr. Fallon, I keep using that because I know the opposition's PowerPoint even refers to one of the studies that he wrote. They're quoting him as an expert, too. And again, the line here is, would you, if this person has this situation, would you recommend treatment? I would definitely recommend treatment. He's one of the national experts, researchers who are quoting on this. In other words, the community is very split. And I say we should be very cautious about this. But again, in Connecticut, where they went through the same debate, it passed unanimously. Because it's a question, we're not recommending a type of treatment. We are definitely not. We don't want to be doing that. What we are saying here is let's let doctors use their best medical judgment. And if the guidelines might be seeing as overstepping, according to even a lot of the researchers involved and a lot of the physicians practicing, and they are seeing some positive benefits on their patients, then we should not sanction them for doing it. So I think this is clearly different from stepping in and saying we're going to recommend this treatment.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a concern, though, and I'm not a physician, but I do know that long-term antibiotic treatment can lead to other types of problems, such as C. diff, and I can't remember what the full term is, but very, very serious effects of not having, of being on antibiotic therapy for too long, and people becoming resistant to antibiotics when they need the antibiotic treatment. And so I think we are venturing into a territory that really needs to be left to research since we don't understand what the complicating factors might be.
But Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I think that it's important that we're even talking about it now because we all, our bosses, I think, at least I'm hearing from my bosses, the people that elected me, are saying there's a problem. I'm not getting the treatment that I need. And so I think it's our duty to at least talk about this and move something forward and send a message that, you know, there seems to be a problem. So next question, Senator Higgins.
But, Mr. Chair, if we're sending something forward that doesn't have any scientific basis, are we doing the best thing for our constituents? That's, I think, part of what our question before us today is. But I'm trying to drag science out of my brain, and it's been a really long time, Dr. LaFond, since I've thought about some of this stuff. But Lyme disease is a bacteria caused by a tick bite. Am I right?
Correct.
Okay, and so then you get a course of antibiotics to kill the spirochetes, right?
Correct.
So then after that course of antibiotics is done and the spirochetes are gone, then why would you continue with a long-term course of antibiotics?
Dr. LaFont?
That's a good question. The problem is the spirochete is not gone. The spirochete has an ability to change its form, to hide out in the cells of the body, and become resistant or insensitive to the particular antibiotic that we might be using. It's a very complicated and complex disease, and we don't have all the research. And that's exactly what the problem is, because the guidelines state that treating a patient with a course of antibiotics is plenty sufficient to take care of the problem. When in fact, in reality, the patients that we have, that I see, that others have seen, they have been treated appropriately, but they still come back with the disease. They still have problems, and we need to treat longer term. And in fact, we're going to present four patients to you today who were, in fact, diagnosed with Lyme disease that needed long-term antibiotics in order to get improvement and feel better.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, it reminds me of people I've known who have had shingles. I can remember once reading in one of the medical journals that the diagnosis was something like, you may as well pray because that's about as good as anything else, because they don't know a scientific way to actually get to the heart of the problem with shingles. And I've had friends, too, who have had Lyme disease that has just wrecked their lives. And I'm really struggling with this this course. And maybe the bill is getting to the point where we need to get to, where there isn't any cause of action against the physician without determining whether we're saying long-term antibiotics is the right course of action or whether it's something else. And I have to admit, I'm just really struggling with the right thing to do here. And so I'll continue to listen more.
Thank Mr. Chairman.
You. Senator Marty.
I would suggest we move on with the testimony for right now and have more discussion later. But, Senator Higgins, I think your last point is exactly what it is. The point is that there's big dispute over this. There's need for more research. There's need for more work. It's clearly had a positive impact on some people. Some of the lead researchers who have been, their studies are being used to argue against this bill are saying they would treat in these situations in certain cases. And the point is what you said at the end. Yes, I think we should let the physicians do their work. And this bill is basically saying let's let them do their work until we know more. But let's have the testimony, because I think it's – otherwise we'll go through all this and then the testimony will – may answer some of the questions. And I think both sides' testimony would be helpful.
I think I will take one more question if you want to ask a question. Now, you did have your hand up, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor, and Senator Marty. So my question – is in terms of the process of the whole thing, just disease itself over here. But has your group and organization been before the Board of Medical Practice to, you know, ask them if they would change the regulations? And that's why you're here today, because as part of a process piece you haven't been able to resolve with the board, and then now you need legislative intervention? Because I'm always a fan of solving it at the lowest possible level. And if there's a way that we can resolve this without legislative intervention and say the board would pledge to not punish or prosecute any doctors until a certain time that we have more evidence that we could make evidence-based decisions, would that be acceptable?
Dr. LaFon.
There's no way I can speak for the Board of Medical Practice. But they're a disciplinary board. Their job is to take a complaint and look at it and then make their decision. They don't make preemptive decisions as far as I know. But again, I can't speak to that.
Okay. Doctor, thank you for your testimony. And the next person on the list here is Mr. Mark Thompson and his son, Chris. If you'd step up to the table and state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony. And welcome to the Capitol. We're glad to have you here.
Hi, I'm Chris Thompson.
Hi, I'm Mark Thompson from St. Paul. And when it's not snowing in the summer, we spend a lot of time in the Brainerd Lakes area. I'm president of our church council and scout troop committee chairman for my son's troop. I have an electrical engineering degree from the University of Minnesota and an MBA from the Carlson School of Management. In July of 2008, a year and a half ago, our son Chris, age 15, was a good AB student with an interest in law and sports management. He was a super athlete, fantastic at second base in both school and community leagues. He's a life scout and spent a week at Tomahawk Scout Camp, where he finished the swimming merit badge with a banged up knee. He was eager to start his first year in the senior high as a ninth grader. In August of 2008, he became fatigued and had a fever. The pediatrician ordered tests. We got a positive for ehrlichiosis, a Lyme co-infection, and received 3 weeks of doxycycline. Near the start of school, Chris started getting terrible debilitating headaches with fatigue and neck tension. We tried a number of doctors, chiropractors, physical therapists, acupuncturists to find relief, and were terribly unsuccessful. He started missing quite a bit of school. In October, only 3 months after the bite and after a treatment, Chris was now down to 2 classes a day. He was only able to attend school a few days a week. His symptoms now included light and sound sensitivity and, on occasion, speech difficulty. His ninth grade year was lost. In December, the pain of the headaches worsened, and Chris developed a tremor of the arm and neck when the pain was extremely bad. You could see the pain in his eyes. The Mayo neurologist was also concerned and ordered additional tests. We finally ran through the entire list of drugs that the neurologist was willing to try, and we ended his treatment with his wish of good luck. In February, because of a follow-up call from the Minnesota Department of Health regarding the ehrlichiosis, we decided to review Lyme symptoms, and we found headache, fatigue, and neck tension, along with the other odd things that Chris was suffering. We went right away to an infectious disease doctor at the University of Minnesota, who didn't want to look at the symptom list. He literally laughed us out of his office with a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, instructions to find a psychiatrist, and to suck it up. As parents, we were completely dumbfounded. We had no idea what had just happened. It was clear that something deeper was going on and that this doctor was clearly not interested in helping this visibly sick 15-year-old who'd rather be playing baseball than lying on the couch. We learned that there are 2 standards of care, and clearly the doctor that we just visited was using the IDSA playbook. We needed to locate someone who knew and practiced the ILADS guidelines, which recognized the chronic Lyme disease that Chris seemed to be suffering from. We identified a few doctors in Minnesota who knew Lyme and the ILADS guidelines. A doctor in northern Minnesota agreed to see us after we got labs accomplished. His first available appointment wasn't for 7 months. 7 months to wait while Chris continued to get worse was not acceptable. 12 months after the bite, the blood test came back, and the pediatrician reported that they were negative for HME and negative for Lyme. His diagnosis was TMJ. Much later, we learned that these results were actually positive, and the physician apologized for not knowing better. Since we did not want to wait for the November appointment in northern Minnesota, we went to Mayo Infectious Disease. The infectious disease person, after hearing our entire history, held up the negative test result from a test they ran and said, "You don't have Lyme. See, it's negative. You don't have Lyme." During the summer, Chris gave all his energy to play baseball games. He didn't have the energy to do practices, and after a game, he was completely exhausted. Baseball kept him going. On the financial side, the financial impact to our family has been a staggering $16,000 in out-of-pocket expense in the year 2009. This is necessitated by wife keeping her job and not being able to care for our son at home. It was clear that we had to identify a doctor out of state. We're going to have to travel to find someone to help our sick son. We called a doctor in Missouri and were able to get an earlier appointment. In the meantime, Chris started the 10th grade in much the same manner as the year before, a partial day and able to attend an average of 3 days per week. 15 months after the bite, we met the doctor in Missouri, and he apologized for the medical community, indicating that it was crazy that we needed to come to Missouri while so many of his patients were from Minnesota and Wisconsin. He has moved his practice so that he can start teaching Lyme and its treatment at the University of Missouri. This doctor understands that Minnesotans should be able to be treated by doctors in Minnesota. During the appointment, the doctor confirmed that with the test that Chris had Lyme and 2 co-infections, and an antibiotic treatment was established. Now, 18 months after the bite and after 3 months of treatment, we have seen several occurrences of several good days in a row. A good day is a headache at a level that he can deal with, a partial day of school, and teasing his sisters or playing with his friends at night, and simply being able to do it again the next day. Our family thanks you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Chris, do you want to say anything to the committee?
Just that I wish they could have found out sooner and had more aggressive treatment plan. So now it's at the late stages, and it's harder to treat than earlier on.
Thanks, Chris. Any questions of the committee? Well, on behalf of the committee, we want to thank you very much for coming up here. Your story was really needed to be heard. Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Thompson. Next on the list is it Michelle Backus? Okay, Michelle, if you want to step up to the table and state your name for the tape, and then go ahead and proceed forward with your testimony.
I'm Michelle Backus, and this is my husband Ron from Lindstrom, Minnesota. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, senators, and fellow members of this committee. Please listen. I hope you can hear this.
I have a question for you, and then there's somebody that wants to speak with you. She has Lyme, and she's with your site, and I don't want to give out your phone number without, you know, talking to you. She asked me for it, and she's going through quite a bit with the doctors and Lyme. So if you could give me a call back, I'd appreciate it.
I have received more than a dozen of these calls in the last 12 days. People are sick. They need help. And they need a Minnesota, they're looking for a Minnesota doctor to treat them for Lyme. I have a website just because I can't keep up with the volume. So they find out about me through word of mouth. It's frustrating. I'll pull myself together. Unfortunately, though, I have had to send them out of state to find a doctor. Why are they calling me? I'm an Ole. I'm a St. Olaf College graduate with my master's degree in education. I'm the chaplain for the Minnesota Lynx for the whole last decade. I am a licensed social studies Minnesota high school teacher and teaching everything from psychology to government. In fact, how a bill becomes a law. But why am I barraged with these phone calls from desperate sick people and their families? I'm not a doctor, nor do I give medical advice. It all started on May 6, 2006. I was bit by a tick. It was a Lyme-infected tick. The teacher in me made you a little handout. You'll see on your, it's a colored one in your packets there, illustrating my battle. I was placed on antibiotics for 10 days, the standard treatment, and I was fine. Whew! Escaped that bullet in my mind. 3 months later, I'm doing a triathlon with my college roommate, and I have some numbness on my face. By the end of the triathlon, my right leg was numb. That was a Saturday. By Monday, my whole right side of my body, my right arm, my right leg, and my face. Obviously, I went into the doctor and ran everything from, is this a stroke? I was only 35 at the time. I thought, is this the beginning of 35? And by she ordered a brain MRI. By that Tuesday, I had the results, and I had 3 brain lesions. Oh, she said, Michelle, I'm sorry. It looks like MS. Not the words that anybody would want to hear. Classic MS. 15 days later, I spent 5 days in the hospital. I couldn't walk. I couldn't see out of the left side of my eye. I had Bell's palsy on the left side of my face. I had vertigo that was, I had never had that before, and I never want that again. I had intense vomiting. This was technically my second episode, so this would confirm an MS diagnosis in their books. And I was ready to start on MS medication, which is, for those of you that know, thousands of dollars a month for the shots. Being a teacher, though, that emphasizes critical thinking. And using your common sense, I wanted to apply it to my own situation. Bit by a tick. Short-term antibiotic treatment. I knew this bacteria was very stealthy. And I was completely fine before the tick bite. I was going to do further research on this Lyme disease stuff. And being a college basketball player, I couldn't help to think this was a slam dunk case. But I could not find a doctor in this state that would treat me for what looked like late Lyme. Some were even saying there isn't such a thing. My life and my family's life, those little punks right over there, as we knew it, was on the line. I was going to do whatever I could in my power to get better for me and for them. I had heard of other independent medical doctors. They're having huge success rates in other states in treatment of Lyme. So we gassed up the van, and we're on our way to Missouri. What I found was amazing and changed my life forever, and lives of many others in Minnesota. My husband, Ron, who is also a hunter and avid Minnesota outdoorsman, has pulled off numerous, countless numbers of ticks, was also treated for Lyme. Is this an epidemic? I was on a variety of antibiotics for 15 months to make sure I not only killed the Lyme bacteria, but other co-infections that we don't have the science yet for. I am now symptom-free and have no new brain lesions. Antibiotics saved my life. Long-term use of them. I also finished Grandma's Marathon in Duluth this last summer in 91-degree heat. Woohoo! The mother in me is hopeful for the future healthcare and the increase and better improvement of healthcare for our children. The chaplain in me is pumped to help people get better. And the social studies teacher in me is very excited to watch this democratic process in action. Significant, wonderful Minnesota history can be made with the passage of this bill. People's voices can be heard. Please listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Backus, why is it that you could be treated in Missouri rather than Minnesota? What was different there?
Two issues. There's a physician that has... I'm sorry.
Mrs. Backus.
I'm sorry. There are two issues probably that come to my mind right away. There is a physician there that is working independently and has worked on... He's a Lyme literate doctor, has done Lyme only for 18 years. I was 35, and I'm going to go for someone who is expertise in this and has had notable success until you can do these double-blind studies when some people don't even know they get bit by a tick. That's part of it. I was a slam-dunk case, like I say, because I had the tick like a good Girl Scout. My mom's here. I brought the tick in Scotch tape. I didn't even get tested. There's controversy in the testing. I'm a classic Lyme case. Bullseye rash and everything, which some don't even get a bullseye. It's very hard. It's a very tricky bacteria. So I wanted to go there. And also, I couldn't find a doctor here because they're, ooh, this is controversial. They're nervous. And not knowing anything about it and having a little zip and gumption, I'm like, I just want some more antibiotics from what I see and have researched. And they're like, yeah, I could get in trouble. This guy's really good. Go to him. You're a great case. So that's part of it. There is a looming fear of this sanctioning when it shouldn't be. And I was on antibiotics for 15 months. The specialist also had me on something for my gut. I had no side effects with antibiotics whatsoever. No stomach problems, nothing.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Ms. Backus,
yes.
Are the board practices different in Missouri? Or was this physician just willing to provide a different type of treatment, regardless of what the guidelines were?
I can't speak to the board practices in Minnesota versus Missouri. I know that he has spent thousands of his own dollars trying to stay in business because people are saying, well, what about this? What about that? I can bust out a cartwheel on this cool carpet. It's my best science, I can tell you. I can't speak to that, but you can see my brain MRIs. I don't know. And it's just really in the meanwhile. I think we're going to get there. But I think people are finding out, like many other times, we just need, in the meanwhile, to let that doctor. If I wouldn't have had any of this. I wouldn't be in this club that I didn't want to be in if I could have had longer. I was only on for 10 days. So I would have been probably, I can't say, but I think I would have had no issues if I had been on longer, maybe even 4 weeks. I don't know even what the standard is, 21 days, maybe 4 weeks. I needed longer.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it very much. Jana King, are you here?
Yeah. My understanding was I was going to be towards the end of the group because I'm doing some wrap-up, but I'll go.
Well, this is the way you're on the list, unless you want to go last, or that's fine. Go ahead. Chris Erickson. Welcome, Mr. Erickson. If you could state your name for the tape and go ahead and proceed forward with your testimony. Welcome to the Capitol and the committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Erickson. I'm a lifelong Minnesota resident, 38 years old. happily married to my wife, Holly. I have three wonderful children, live in a small town in Chisago County. It is my honor to be before you today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, on behalf of this important bill. I'm here to share with you a story of darkness. The story is mine, and it begins in 1985 when I was 14. That year I played sports, I was an avid fisherman, an amateur deer hunter, and in the early summer a tick bit me. A strange rash appeared over my entire chest, then spread to my thighs. It was not a classic bullseye rash. Instead, there were many small red rings that grew and changed shape. I had some swollen glands and some low-grade fevers, and the rash faded away on its own in about 7 days and was soon forgotten. What came next was pitch black. 6 months after the tick bite and rash, my left hand began to tremor, and I was unable to hold things in it, like a toothbrush or a pencil. I was now 15. New symptoms arrived with astonishing speed and intensity. No one connected these signs with the tick bite. I could only do that later, much, much later. Some of the unusual and life-stealing symptoms that appeared with my tremor were profound short-term memory loss, neck rigidity and shoulder pain, periods of paralysis, crushing exhaustion, facial numbing and masking, shuffled and distorted walking gait, unrelenting insomnia, major chronic depression, intense vertigo, and extraordinary muscle pains. I was horribly sick. These symptoms all had one thing in common. They never let up. They never stopped. Still, at the age of 15, I was referred to the chief pediatric neurologist at Children's Hospital of St. Paul. Her diagnosis was young onset Parkinson's disease. I was taken for a second opinion to a world-renowned physician in Chicago, who after a short exam pronounced that I only had essential tremor and told me to return to being a teenager. I tried to do that and could not. So for the next 14 years, I searched the darkness. I saw many doctors and endured countless tests, including many scans. All came back normal. Many thousands of healthcare dollars were spent without effect. I was tested for Lyme disease at least 4 times. And never tested positive. Miraculously, I was employed and still married. In 1999, I was weary in my soul. At one of my numerous doctor visits, I was referred to a movement disorder neurologist at a respected local Parkinson's clinic. He re-diagnosed me at age 30 with young onset Parkinson's disease. I began 3 years of treatment with an arsenal of Parkinson's disease medication. There was no reprieve, and my symptoms continued. The hope was that I was slowing an eventual decline to total disability. My story should end here, in the dark. In 2004, while searching for new treatments for Parkinson's disease, I found a group of patients on an internet forum who claimed that a particular magnesium supplement helped their tremor. As a father, I was intent on effective treatment. I began taking this magnesium along with the Parkinson's disease medication, and my tremor almost disappeared. One of the members then told me that the group of patients all had Lyme disease, and the magnesium helped them. A light began to glimmer in my darkness. It was then I remembered the tick bite and mysterious rash so long ago. I asked for a Western blot test for Lyme disease from my Parkinson's doctor. It showed some evidence of infection, but still was not positive. My doctor dismissed the idea of Lyme disease infection, and I left his care. On my last appointment, he said he was sure I would return to the Parkinson's clinic. I searched with great intensity for a Lyme disease doctor in Minnesota, and there were none to be found. I searched next door in Wisconsin, That effort was fruitless as well. I then found an experienced physician for treating late-stage Lyme disease, and I found him in southern Missouri. Hastily, I was on a plane to a small independent storefront clinic to receive the treatment that cured my infection. This talented doctor evaluated, diagnosed, and treated me for late-stage Lyme disease with a combination of five common oral antibiotics over a period of 11 and a half months. At month four, my tremor went away completely. By month 9 and 10, all of my major Parkinson's disease symptoms disappeared. Dawn had broke. Since 2005, I have been symptom-free. My case of tick-borne illness was cured after 18 years of infection. I haven't been back to the Parkinson's clinic. To me, there is only one thing more sinister than my experience with Lyme disease in Minnesota. It is the fact there are many thousands now suffering in the same darkness of misdiagnosis as I did. They are untreated, undertreated, and just plain abandoned. Please be a light to them. I urge you to pass this bill.
Mr. Erickson, thank you so much for your testimony. Dr. Elizabeth Maloney.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Janet, are you ready?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty, your last testifier and some earlier testifiers indicate that they've been tested for Lyme, but it's been negative, or they've been retested and it's been negative, and I obviously don't know enough about the situation. Why is that the case? Why does that happen?
Senator Marty.
I will defer some of that to Dr. Maloney, but bottom line is that there's some of these tests that, you know how tests have false positives. Some of them don't catch everything either. There's a dispute over which tests and how much of the testing to do, and it's a very, I'm not an expert in this, I just know that it's a very hard one to find, and there are a lot of people who have, with the standard test that the protocol calls for, has not found it with some.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
but
Johnson.
Again, some of the experts will say it's there, too.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, I've been studying this extensively over the interim, and the short answer, Dr. Betty Maloney will testify in detail about it, but the pathogen is a spirochete, and as it goes through the cell wall, it gets cloaked. So sometimes that's one of the reasons you get a false positive. There are many, and they'll continue to testify, but that's kind of the easy answer.
Jana King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. I'm Jana King. I'm a resident of Minneapolis, a native of southern Minnesota, a graduate of Gustavus, a former Chamber of Commerce executive, and since 1994, an economic development consultant. At our family's northern Minnesota cabin last July, I was bitten by a deer tick. We removed the tick, and I watched for Lyme symptoms, including fever and the famous target rash. Over the next month, I rationalized a growing list of aches and pains as part of yard work and part of growing older. I also watched as my dog aged remarkably, limping pathetically and sleeping constantly. Finally, it dawned on me, we were both exhibiting the fatigue and joint pain associated with Lyme disease. We responded quickly and dramatically to the antibiotics. My family physician gave me 3 weeks of antibiotics, and it extended it a week at my request because significant symptoms returned if I missed a dose by just a few hours. After that, she referred me to an infectious disease specialist. It took a few weeks to get an appointment. The infectious disease doctor explained that he didn't prescribe long-term antibiotics for Lyme and ordered $800 of tests. As I waited for the results, my health spiraled downward, and strange new symptoms arose every few days. Yet I felt confident all would be well. After all, they drew a lot of blood. A few weeks later, his nurse called and told me all the tests were negative. I explained that I was feeling terrible and getting progressively worse since I was off the antibiotics. She said there wasn't anything further they could do, maybe take some anti-inflammatories. I wondered at the time why she kept saying, this is all really controversial. It was a mystery to me. I was just fumbling into it all at that point in time. Well, I didn't know what to do. I was really going downhill. The fatigue and joint aches, shortness of breath, brain fog, sleep disruption, and other neuro symptoms were definitely taking their toll on my work. My family physician said it was out of her realm, and the specialist wasn't going to do anything. I was dragging myself through the grocery store when I ran into a childhood friend who's an MD. He said hello cheerfully and asked how I was doing. I told him, I've got Lyme disease and I'm not doing well. He was very concerned and asked about the type of testing I had and the type of treatment. Because I didn't know where to turn, I asked for his contact information and got an appointment a couple of weeks later. He did a fantastic job of explaining the biology and challenges of Lyme and prescribed an antibiotic. Within 2 days, I felt so much better, I cried. And ever since, I've been highly aware that without that chance encounter, I would have been in serious trouble. I've also continued to see my family physician, who was rated by her peer physicians as one of the top doctors in Minnesota. Over the past several months, she has said to me, the science isn't resolved on Lyme. And a week ago, she saw me and said, you are so lucky you walked into the grocery store that day. Without the antibiotics that were restarted in November, there's no question in my mind I wouldn't be able to testify here today. In late November, I pulled out a disability policy I purchased in 1996 and hadn't looked at for 13 years. I realized I was dangerously close, to the point where fatigue and brain fog were going to require me to dramatically cut back or shut down my business. I was very grateful that work slowed down over the holidays. I managed to struggle through, deferring deadlines, relying on friends and family and associates. In early January, I was feeling much more normal, more good days, more stamina, mental clarity, less fatigue, and joint pain. The physician, who is courageous enough to treat me, believes you need antibiotics long-term to avoid a wide range of serious problems. But that nurse was right. It's all very controversial. Some physician groups might not agree with him or my treatment plan. But if $54 worth of generic antibiotics and a quick check-in with the doctor every few weeks can make me feel this much better, I know where I stand. Minnesota physicians need the freedom and protection to treat individuals with Lyme disease using their best professional judgment, including the option for long-term Lyme or antibiotics. I felt dramatically better with the support of antibiotics and am convinced that without them, I would be on at least partial disability and going from doctor to doctor, treating a host of symptoms, but not the cause. Instead of being an active, productive citizen and taxpayer, I would be a burden for my family and friends and a burden on the healthcare system. If by chance I hadn't run into a childhood friend who is an MD in private practice, who is compassionate, meticulous, and research-oriented, I would likely be traveling at least 2 to 3 hours or 2 to 5 states away. Access to prompt local treatment shouldn't depend on a chance encounter. Of course, all of this could have been avoided if my family physician could have extended the antibiotics last September. You've heard some of our personal experiences, but let's take our stories and expand them to the larger economic perspective. I'm an economic development person and a chamber exec. I can't help but do this. Minnesota ranks 9th in the U.S. for number of cases. That's a 450% increase since 1999. You can see the bar rising. You can see on the map that Minnesota has a much higher concentration than other parts of the nation. This disease has many costs. Time lost from work. If you're self-employed like me, it means lost income. If you have a job, it means sick leave. It may even mean disability. It costs employers, and it costs families. In Mark's case, his son is struggling to attend school, and the impact on his young life is huge. There's also an impact on the school, on the family, and on the employers who have that health insurance burden. Healthcare costs are ultimately reflected in an employer's insurance rates. Compare the costs of generic antibiotics or other antibiotics with managing a host of lingering symptoms that might be labeled vaguely or misdiagnosed as MS, Parkinson's, or some other disease. Employers with workers engaged outdoors, like weed inspectors, loggers, utility workers, or park rangers, are certainly impacted. Because of the high incidence of Lyme here, Minnesota employers are disproportionately impacted through both the loss of productivity and the increased health care and disability costs. When there's controversy in science, it is not time for one specialty group to control or restrict all others. It is time for curious minds to engage in research and innovation across disciplines. This disease has significant personal and economic costs. The first thing we need to do is make sure Minnesota physicians have the freedom and the protection to treat chronic Lyme. Beyond that, and beyond the scope of this bill, we should make Minnesota the place where the best test for Lyme is developed and patented. Improved testing could avoid misdiagnosis and the related costly, unnecessary, and ineffective treatments. We should be the place that develops a reputation as the best place in the nation to come for treatment. Let's turn this economic drain into an economic advantage. But that's down the road. The first step is passing this bill so physicians can treat individuals without delay here in Minnesota, using their best professional judgment, including the option to treat with long-term antibiotics. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't get the testifier's name.
It's Jana King. Ms. King.
Thank you, Ms. King. Could I ask you what your antibiotic is?
Ms. King?
Ceftin.
Ceftin? And what type of antibiotic is that?
Cephalosporin.
Okay. And so it's
Senator
just,
Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, sorry. in studying this, I found that the first line of defense is minocycline or doxycycline, just a real common tetracycline-type drug. I'd like to testify and say as witness that my son has been on it for 5 years for acne. Very, very easily tolerated medicine. And if we could get out front with that long term for some of these people, we wouldn't have to go beyond that. That's what I'd like to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Any other questions? Okay. Is there a Dr. Elizabeth Maloney going to testify to? We got you on the list here. Sure. Step up to the table, state your name for the tape, and go ahead and proceed forward, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Dr. Betty Maloney. I know some questions were deferred to me, but I'll go through my presentation first, if that's all right. And I'm from Wyoming, Minnesota. As a physician, I'm called to talk on many topics, and I've listed them here. My involvement with Lyme disease is relatively recent. I've been chief of staff at District Memorial Hospital. At Fairview Lakes, I filled many roles. Within a line of medical clinics, which is a system of over 40 clinics and employing over 400 physicians, I wrote clinic policies, advised the administration on patient-related topics, and served on the board of directors. In short, I'm not a fringe physician. My involvement with Lyme disease is in the area of education. I'm not treating patients at this time. I wrote a paper on Lyme discussing the need for clinical judgment. I've created accredited continuing education courses for healthcare professionals. My most recent course was accredited by the American Academy of Family Physicians. Just a few points about the science. We're still learning. We don't know everything, and there's much we have yet to learn. studies substantiate the experiences of Chris, Michelle, and Chris, our available tests are inadequate. Common antibiotic treatments are based on limited studies and don't help everyone. The question of what to do with those who remain ill is unresolved. Persistent infection in humans is well documented in peer-reviewed journals. Persistence has been also documented in animal studies. NIH studies and case reports document that long-term antibiotics and retreatment are beneficial. Rarely do patients have serious antibiotic side effects. SF-1631 is often called the Physician Protection Bill because it protects physicians from inappropriate medical board investigations and sanctions. This is an important and necessary safeguard. But SF-1631 is also about freedom. For patients, it's freedom of choice. The AMA recognizes that patients are free to choose their physicians and their course of therapy. But before they can act, patients must receive information about their options. This process is called informed consent, and the AMA promotes it as a patient right. Informed consent requires physicians discuss treatment options with patients, including the risks and benefits of each option. In Lyme disease, many physicians are quick to point out the potential risks and costs of long-term antibiotic treatment, often minimizing its benefits. Yet physicians rarely describe the risks and costs associated with not treating or undertreating this illness. And the benefits of short courses of antibiotics are often inflated. Unfortunately, without access to physicians who are willing to treat and honor their choices, patients lack true autonomy and informed consent. Now, here's the ideal situation. The evidence and patient goals are in balance. This is a situation in Lyme disease where the evidence is uncertain and evolving, so patient goals are more important. Now, studies report an average result. They can't predict an individual's outcome. People differ in how they tolerate treatment and in what they hope to achieve. And that's why it's never appropriate to ignore a patient's goals and concerns. Risk-benefit analyses are best done between a patient and their treating physician. As an editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association pointed out, guidelines don't provide individualized care. This bill frees physicians to use all of their skills to treat Lyme disease patients. As Dr. LaFond spoke about, using clinical judgment, SF-1631 recognizes and preserves that right. The AMA's principles of medical ethics tell physicians that patients' needs are primary, and we are to be advocates for them. But as Dr. LaFond mentioned, it's difficult to follow those principles when you believe doing so threatens your license and livelihood. Numerous patients have told me their physicians were afraid to treat them. You should have received a letter by Gina Empey stating this very thing. Occasionally, I even get calls from physicians who express this concern. SF-1631 removes this perceived threat, will help with the access issues raised by Mark and Michelle and Chris, and decrease healthcare costs by reducing the need to travel. This bill does not force any particular treatment agenda on patients, physicians, or insurers. Physicians are free to choose their physicians and treatment plans that meet their needs and goals. Physicians are not forced to treat, but they're free to treat based on their clinical judgment. And insurance coverage is not mandated. In fact, this bill is silent with regards to insurance. To summarize, we have real people with real illness, and their illnesses appear to be late or chronic Lyme disease, and they appear to respond to long-term antibiotics. The IDSA guidelines do not adequately address the needs of these people or others like them. Yet these very guidelines are used in other states to restrict the use of long-term antibiotics for Lyme disease. Right now, in Minnesota, the threat of a Board of Medical Practice investigation is significantly limiting the number of physicians who are willing to treat. Some say this is carve-out legislation. Why Lyme disease and not others? It's because no other disease that I know of has such restrictive guidelines, guidelines written by a single private organization, guidelines used by medical boards to restrict treatment. Some say long-term antibiotics are dangerous. They aren't. All treatments have risks, and there are risks from inadequately treated disease. Informed consent is no different in Lyme disease than for other illnesses that we treat.
Dr. Maloney, can I ask you, are you almost done?
Yes.
Okay, because we've got several members who have questions, and we got some people that want to speak opposed to the bill. Getting nervous.
Some say the placebo-controlled trials don't support our position. They're wrong. We have other evidence in this room today. This evidence should be enough to convince you that there's more to Lyme than the IDSA guidelines suggest. While the medical community works to understand the complexities of Lyme disease and to develop more appropriate guidelines, we're asking for protection. Please free us to prescribe long-term antibiotics for people suffering from this illness, Minnesotans like Chris, Michelle, Chris, and Jana.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Doctor, I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. I have a couple of questions, someone relating to the earlier testimony as well that were deferred. But as I understand the process that was described with the Board of Medical Practice, that they address things on complaint. If you are treating a person that you have diagnosed with Lyme disease with long-term antibiotics and they benefit from that, who complains?
Dr. Maloney.
Thank you. Well, any number of people could complain. Out east, some of the common complaints came from insurers, so who's ever footing the bill complains. Sometimes peers complain because they don't understand why you're doing what you're doing. I'm not sure in Minnesota, in some states, you're not privy to the identity of who complains. But so, yes, complaints often come from people that aren't the patient you're treating.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Han.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there complaints that are generated by people who get the long-term antibiotic treatment that don't respond to the treatment and then complain to someone that their physician recommended something that turned out not to have an effect or may have been detrimental? Does that ever happen in the course of this?
Dr. Maloney.
Sorry. Yes, I think that has happened, but I don't, to be honest, keep track of all of those.
Okay.
And Senator Han.
Yes, and one, I guess, final kind of a question here. The number of things that you referred to in your testimony that you talked about the difficulty in diagnosing, the great debate going on among medical professionals about this disease and how to identify it and the testing regimens and treatment of it and the problem with the restrictive guidelines. None of those things are addressed in the bill.
Dr. Maloney.
And my question, Mr. Chairman, is the things that you're referring to as the primary problems by passing the bill doesn't make those problems get any better. It would rely on the fact that if this bill were passed, that there would be a lot of doctors who would then decide to do things that right now they don't feel justified doing. And I'm not sure, it hasn't gotten clear to me that they're not doing those things because of the restriction in the medical board guidelines. But can you help me with that? Why would this help resolve those problems that you testified to as being the significant ones?
Well,
Dr. Maloney.
One thing is that the bill does say that physicians may use their clinical judgment. The Infectious Disease Society of America, their guidelines do not allow for clinical judgment. And so the proper way to diagnose a patient with any illness is to take a thorough history and perform an exam develop a clinical impression, and then try to confirm that impression with testing. In Lyme disease, we use what's called serology to do that. The serologic tests are poor. So if I have strong clinical impression but a negative test, where the infectious disease doctors would say that I have to let the test trump my opinion. And that's very unusual. Usually in medicine, we don't do that. And so clinical judgment is a very necessary component, and that's what this bill allows. And so that helps tremendously. And there are indeed physicians who are concerned about being hauled in front of the board or investigated, and so they don't treat, as Ms. Empey's physician stated to her. And so this bill would certainly open the door for those physicians to be comfortable about treating. You know, my goal is I do write educational programs on Lyme to try to explain it so that even physicians who choose not to treat would at least understand the basis for their colleagues treating.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, I don't see on our agenda today that we're going to be hearing from the Board of Medical Practice, but I wondered if you might be able to provide any insight to the committee on conversations that you may have had, presumably with them. And secondly, are there Minnesota physicians who have been sanctioned?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, answer the second one is no, there have not been, because there have not been any complaints. Now at the board, we met with them several times in the last couple of years, and they say we only act on complaints. They have no intention of bringing a complaint. We also have letters in your packets from a couple of doctors and who have said they don't treat and they're afraid of this. We've heard from a lot of others who weren't particularly interested in sending letters on it, but who say they don't want to treat because they feel insecure about this. But the board, who I believe is here today, they say they have no intention of pursuing this. Nevertheless, the trouble is doctors are saying, you know, I could lose my license over this. And the board is looking at, and we're hearing, you'll hear testimony in a few minutes from people from the Infectious Disease Society saying, well, these are our guidelines, and there are people who think the board should be sanctioning for it. So, no, this is Dr. Maloney and several others point out, a different situation. They're very seldom will you have that strict a guideline saying you must do it this way, especially when the tests don't come up positive all the time. And, I mean, this one letter from this Gina Empey who's saying she couldn't find a doctor. Her doctor apologized for not doing it, and she talked about how she had this three times they had the same test that showed it was negative, and then she kept asking for the other one. She finally found the other test, and that one showed it was positive. So, again, when you've got tests that aren't definitive, and, I mean, my whole hope of this is that we can just let the doctors practice until we have better medical decisions on this.
Dr. Maloney, thanks for your testimony. If we could get Dr. Bakken to come to the table, and then Dave Renner to come to the table at the same time. And as they're coming up here, I wanted to point out Senator Vanderveer, I think, is in the room. He's working with Senator Marty and others on this bill, and we just wanted to recognize him and thank him for that. And we normally don't recognize the other body, but since I have the chair, I want to recognize Representative Detmer is here, and he's working in the other body, and Representative Ward is also working on this in the other body, and we appreciate them. I know he is. He's my House member, and we appreciate his hard work, too. So, Dr. Bakken, if you could state your name for the committee and go ahead and proceed forward with your testimony, and we welcome you to the committee.
My name is Johan Bakken. I'm an infectious disease physician in Duluth, Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the Infectious Disease Society of America, of which I am a member. I thank the board for asking me to, or inviting me to come and speak. The Infectious Disease Society of America is a group of roughly 8,000 ID-trained physicians. In addition to being a member, I'm also a member of the National Council of the Board of Directors of IDSA, and I happen to be one of the co-authors of the Infectious Disease Society's treatment guidelines document on Lyme disease and related tick-borne illnesses. In contrast to what Dr. Maloney said, IDSA is not a private organization. It's a voluntary organization of like-trained physicians. And I would also like to add that on the page one of the treatment guidelines document, which was published November 1, 2006, in Clinical Infectious Diseases, it is clearly stated that guidelines are voluntary and cannot supplant individual clinical judgment. The treatment guidelines document, like so many treatment guidelines documents, was meant to be a tool for practicing physicians who may or may not have a lot of experience with tick-borne illnesses. The author panel consisted of 14 experts in tick-borne infections. I was invited primarily because of my discovery of human granulocytic ehrlichiosis, which we published on initially in 1994. However, through my practice of infectious diseases for 22 years in Duluth, I've had numerous occasions to see and treat patients with Lyme disease. What the author panel strived to do was to review all published peer-reviewed literature debating the topics of Lyme disease, human granulocytic ehrlichiosis, which is now called anaplasmosis, and babesiosis. We strive to seek out articles that were a reflection of evidence-based scientific research, and the strength of the recommendations based on the publication was rated on a scale from A to E, where A would be the highest ranking, and the quality of evidence. We particularly looked for blinded, randomized, and prospective in research articles. We ended up with 405 references that were all included in the document. And after the treatment guidelines had been finalized and submitted for review to the publications committee, the guidelines were reviewed by an independent peer review group prior to their final acceptance and publication. Each of the authors disclosed all potential conflicts of interest according to the guidelines that had been set forth by the Infectious Disease Society of America. The 2006 guidelines updated the previous set of guidelines published in 2000. There were some new elements and some reinforcement of other previous recommendations. The antibiotic treatment recommendations discussed both early and late stage Lyme disease and concluded that a period of 10 to 28 days of antibiotics administered in an intravenous and or oral form would suffice for the treatment of the majority of cases of Lyme disease. The duration of treatment would depend on the stage of illness at the time of diagnosis. There was new and added information about the treatment, diagnosis, and treatment of anaplasmosis and babesiosis, and the document this time discussed the value or the use, potential use, of single-dose antibiotic prophylaxis administered after a tick bite, specifically after a deer tick bite. What was also new and has been the source of contention in the medical community was the attempted definition and discussion of the so-called chronic Lyme disease entity, which has also been labeled post-Lyme disease syndrome. As a result of the discussion of chronic Lyme disease, there was then a discussion about whether or not there was any evidence in the published literature for prolonged antibiotic therapy beyond those treatment recommendations that were listed in the document. Based on review of available literature leading up to the time of the publication of the document, there was no evidence-based information in human medicine that recommended lengthy antibiotic therapy beyond 28 days, and I will discuss that briefly in a minute. Chronic Lyme disease, in its broadest sense, would of course be Lyme disease, which has persisted for a number of years and evaded diagnosis and treatment. There is no contention with that definition. In its narrowest form, chronic Lyme disease should be defined as active infection that follows objective diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease after completion of the recommended length of therapy. In addition to being a clinical diagnosis, we have various laboratory tests that can be used to substantiate the clinical diagnostic suspicion. The commonest and most available is the measurement of serum antibodies, but the limitation of serum antibody testing is that it cannot differentiate between active infection and events that have happened in the past, past infection which has been appropriately treated, and occasionally there is even false positive test results because of similarity with somewhat related organisms that also can lead to the formation of antibodies in human serum. Specific diagnostic tests would be the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, which detects presence of Borrelia, the cause of Lyme disease, in tissue, whether it be joint fluid or cerebrospinal fluid. The concentration of Borrelia organisms in blood is usually so low that the PCR test frequently comes up negative, even in the setting of active Borrelia infection. An additional diagnostic test would be culturing the Borrelia organism, and no one would argue against that being a specific diagnostic test result. Typically, we find cultures useful when we biopsy the advancing margin of the skin rash, erythema migrans rash. Occasionally, we can also utilize joint fluid for culture purpose. Recently, there has been some publication about a urine antigen test, which is reputed to detect breakdown products of dying or dead Borrelia organisms as a result of treatment. Unfortunately, the test is very sensitive, but also very non-specific. That means that there's a high degree of false positive test results. And when blinded samples of the same specimen have been tested repeatedly, the reproducibility of the urine antigen test in a study that was published by Dr. Klempner in the American Journal of Medicine in 2001 had a reproducibility rate of only 10%. It ranged from strongly positive to flatly negative. The conclusion, therefore, of the entity chronic Lyme disease, even though we understand that people having had Lyme disease can have lingering symptoms after completion of treatment, there is no published scientific evidence utilizing tests like PCR and culture after completed treatment that documents persistence of infection. No one is arguing against suffering and clinical symptoms in many patients who have completed therapy. However, a study that was just published this week in the American Journal of Medicine from a Czech Republic, a Slovenian study of 230 patients followed for 12 months after completion of oral antibiotic therapy for early stage Lyme disease, only 2.2% of these patients, 5% or 5 patients in all, reported persistence or new symptoms to be present at 12 months. In other words, 225 patients were completely restored. If there is no such an entity as chronic Lyme disease defined by persistence of live bacteria after completion of antibiotic therapy, is there then a role for long-term antibiotic therapy? Up until the publication of the guidelines in 2006, The two first studies cited here have been published. The Klempner study in 2001 studied 78 patients treated initially with IV and/or oral therapy, and then continued IV or oral therapy versus placebo, which basically means sugar pill therapy, for an additional 3 months. The outcomes were that one-third of these patients felt better, one-third felt the same, and one-third felt worse. And there was no difference between the placebo group and the antibiotic treatment group. A couple of years later, Krupp published a study of 55 patients and looked for evidence of improvement in cognitive function and fatigue after treatment with intravenous therapy versus placebo therapy for 28 days following recommended therapy. When using the SF-36 wellness score, there was no change between the placebo group and the treatment group. Following the publication of the guidelines, Fallon's study, which I do have here, evaluated 37 patients and 20 healthy controlled patients that were treated with intravenous therapy versus placebo therapy for 10 weeks following their initial treatment. And Falloon, in his own article, concluded that there was no durable improvement in cognitive function. He did, however, find that 26% of the patients who were treated with intravenous therapy, one in the placebo group and seven in the treatment group, suffered significant consequences of the treatment itself, such as Lyme sepsis, Lyme-associated blood clots in the vascular tree, severe rashes. Fortunately, no one died from these complications, even though it is well known and described as case reports of patients who have succumbed to complications of long-term antibiotic treatment with an indwelling intravenous catheter line. Finally, the fourth study that has been published comparing long-term therapy versus placebo was done in Finland with 152 patients, published by Oxy in 2007. There was no change in how patients described feeling them after completion of this study, and they were followed for up to 12 months. I have all these studies available for those who might want to read them. So, prolonged antibiotic treatment at the current state of knowledge based on evidence in scientific peer-reviewed literature, there is no documented benefit. However, prolonged treatment has the potential for being very harmful. And in addition, I think all of you have heard of multiply-resistant bacteria that we struggle with in our hospital every day, such as MRSA, should ring a bell, vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus faecalis, Faecium. Our troops from Iraq have imported very drug-resistant Acinetobacter organisms. C. difficile diarrhea infection has been mentioned. There are a lot of downsides to long-term antibiotic administration when it is not clearly indicated based on evidence. After the publication of the IDSA guidelines, within a month, the competing organization ILADS, the acronym for the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society, protested and demanded that the guidelines be retracted. And this led subsequently to a subpoena being issued by the Attorney General in the state of Connecticut in November 2006. Attorney General Blumenthal claimed that the authors of the document had conflicts of interest, specifically referencing vaccine development and diagnostic test makers. As to vaccine development, the only available vaccine for Lyme disease was withdrawn voluntarily by after protest by ILADS in 2001. There was no recommendation for any vaccination voiced in the treatment guidelines document. With regard to diagnostic test makers, it is true that some of the members of the panel have been involved in the initial stages of developing diagnostic tests in the early 1990s. However, no specific diagnostic test maker was recommended over another in the document, and none of the tests were that IDSA recommended were proprietary. As a consequence of the subpoena, all authors, myself included, were directed under penalty of law to surrender our email files entirely from 2000 to 2006 for review by the Attorney General staff. In addition, we had to answer, each of us, a detailed 31-point interrogatory set forth by the Attorney General. After a year and a half, IDSA and the Attorney General's office reached an agreement. IDSA decided to settle because of accruing costs for legal defense superseding $1 million by then. The Attorney General and IDSA agreed that they would issue a joint statement to the press. IDSA was not asked to admit fault, and the Attorney General did not request that the guidelines be retracted. Mr. Blumenthal claimed that his investigation had uncovered serious flaws with the developmental process. However, he never revealed what these flaws were. IDSA and the Attorney General agreed that a special review panel should be appointed to review the guidelines document and determine, based on published scientific evidence, whether the guidelines needed to be revised, to be withdrawn, or to be left unchanged. The timeline for the review committee to submit their recommendation was supposed to be the end of the year. There has been so much information to go through that the review committee now has posted a probable release of their statement by the end of March. I believe that the Senate Bill 1631 should not be passed because there simply is no scientific evidence to support the contention that long-term antibiotic therapy has any value for treatment of chronic Lyme disease, since there is no evidence that chronic Lyme disease is a credible entity. There is no published information in human clinical medicine that demonstrates the value of long-term antibiotic administration. It should be understood that some of the drugs that are used for long-term therapy, such as doxycycline, such as macrolides, erythromycin, clarithromycin, azithromycin, and ceftriaxone or rocephin, which is used intravenously, have inflammatory modulating properties. In other words, to some degree, work the same way as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And so patients who are treated with long-term therapy may feel better, not because of the antimicrobial properties of the drugs, but rather the anti-inflammatory properties of the drugs. We have already had a long encounter with multi-resistant bacteria that emerge from the treatment of long-term antibiotic administration. Mr. Darwin was right 200 years ago. It's survival of the fittest. Injudicious antibiotic use can result in patient harm and potential death. And if any decision should be reached by the Senate committee, at the very least, I would urge the committee to wait until the recommendations from the independent treatment guidelines review panel has been surrendered to the Attorney General's office and to IDSA. Thank you.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bakken, so I learned here today that the IDSA is not a federal regulatory agency, nor is it a state regulatory agency, and in fact that the guidelines that you have issued are voluntary. Senator Marty, I'm a little confused. I'm not understanding why Minnesota physicians are taking such issue with this in light of those two statements, and perhaps we'll hear more about that from the MMA. But Dr. Bakken, you've indicated that you recommend against the extended antibiotic therapy. In fact, you say that a normal course of antibiotics would suffice in the majority of cases. In the majority of cases. The people that we heard testimony from today, do they represent the majority of cases? And I'm suspecting not. And so I'm wondering if, in light of that, your organization has suggestions. How are we supposed to address those individuals, those patients who don't fall within that generality of the majority of cases?
Dr. Bakken?
None of the members of IDSA, and it is the majority of the members of the 8,000 members, that believe that the guidelines documents is the best that scientific evidence can demonstrate today. No one believes that patients do not have suffering and symptoms of feeling ill. What we are contesting is whether Lyme disease is the correct diagnosis for these individuals. The fact of the matter is that a large number of individuals who are reputed to have Lyme disease do end up with no evidence based on laboratory testing of having infection, whether it be by antibody testing, which measures footprints of past events or current events, whether it be by culture, whether it be by polymerase chain reaction testing. We do believe that a number of these individuals who have, for the most part, pain syndromes and fatigue, that they do feel better when they are treated with these antibiotic agents for reasons that I've just outlined. I think that when someone has unexplained symptoms, it creates a very significant anxiety state to some degree, a vulnerable patient. And we feel that oftentimes when such patients come in the hands of individuals who say, we will treat you with long-term Lyme disease or antibiotic therapy, that other appropriate workups to unravel what is really going on may be ignored or forgotten. Some of those differential diagnoses have been made reference to here, multiple sclerosis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, chronic fatigue syndrome, various states of depression, underlying malignancies, and other infections that may not be responsive to the antibiotic drugs that are being utilized for treating patients with, quote, chronic Lyme disease.
64. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, I you're doing a very good job. It's good to see
you
again.
Thank you.
Dr. Bakken, I guess I'm getting the impression listening to this, that you don't believe that there's, for the evidence you see, is that there isn't really any chronic Lyme disease. That's again, it's a mystic diagnosis. Is that what I heard you say? If they come up with symptoms that linger beyond the 28-day treatment period, that anything that comes up would be something other than Lyme disease.
Dr. Bakken,
not always. Patients who have had Lyme disease for a long time need longer time periods after completion of treatment to resolve all their symptoms than patients who are diagnosed in early stages of Lyme disease. The explanation for this, we feel, is that there is an intense immune response that the body launches in order to try to get rid of the infectious agent. Even if the organism is killed by the antibiotic therapy that is rendered, these other defense responses don't shut off just like a light switch. And in fact, many of the symptoms, if not most, are driven not so much by the presence of the organism itself, but rather the immune response that the body mounts to try to rid itself of the bacteria. And so that's why anti-inflammatory drugs often will help and make you feel better. That would be also the case for those that are treated with antibiotics with anti-inflammatory properties.
Okay.
Senator Gall.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. So would there ever be a case or a situation then where it would be called for to have a longer than the 28-day treatment, that you would go beyond that 28 days?
Of course.
Dr.
The only
Bakken.
Thing that's certain in life is death and taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are some instances where patients may not have been fully compliant with treatment. There are instances where patients may have taken drugs like doxycycline with a glass of milk because they felt queasy. And calcium and phosphate and elements that are found in antacids like Maalox and Mylanta will chelate or bind to a drug like doxycycline, which is the drug we recommend first against or for treatment of Lyme disease. And when you have a bound drug in the gut, it is not absorbed, which means that you basically have a non-treating situation.
Okay. If I might, one
Senator
last
Dahl.
Question then. If in that case, it sounds as though to me, and this is the way I believe, that it's between a doctor and the patient to kind of make some of those decisions based on the conditions that they're up against. That, you know, the science shows that there's, you know, maybe in general we want a 28-day treatment, makes sense, but that the science is there to support the kind of the art of practicing medicine. And so you have that flexibility. What in this bill are you opposed to that? Because it seems to me that it allows to take that fear factor out of the possible injunctions from the legal system, I guess, of the board coming doing something to the doctor for making a judgment call on that particular patient that they thought was inappropriate, but maybe between the patient and the doctor they felt it was appropriate. And especially since in light of the fact that we have some success stories here, what is it in this bill that would, you know, is objectionable, I guess, to you that would preclude us from having that flexibility and that freedom for the doctor and the patient to choose?
Dr. Bakken.
I think that for the vast majority of patients who are being diagnosed by clinical objective criteria, that is criteria that can clearly be demonstrated and are not of a subjective nature, combined with verification of laboratory testing. In late stages of Lyme disease, virtually everyone will have a positive antibody panel, both the screening antibody test and the mandatory Western blot test panel, which follows everybody with a positive screening test. That's by state law. Those patients, when they are treated for the appropriate length of time and that they are taking their medication, the vast majority of patients will have their infection go away. But as I said, symptoms may linger. And in the absence of any objective laboratory demonstration of persistent presence of live bacteria, of which no one has been able to demonstrate that, I think until we have such evidence, we need to collect or do research that proves that long-term antibiotic therapy is of value. Until such time, I think there are more damage that can be done by long-term antibiotic therapy, not only for the patient, him or herself, but for the community at large, because we exchange bacteria. And we are running into situations where we are running out of antibiotic choices to treat other infections because bacteria have been primed and trained by long-term antibiotic therapy. And lastly, there's the cost issue. Someone mentioned that MS drugs cost a lot, and they do. But long-term antibiotic therapy by intravenous route costs a lot too, and someone has to pick up that tab. And until we have clear evidence that that type of treatment is beneficial, I believe that we need to collect the evidence. And I encourage and challenge the Lyme-literate community to conduct such studies so that they can prove their point. Because up until now, there isn't the scientific evidence.
Senator Hahn had a question, and we've only got about 10 minutes left, and Mr. Renner wants to speak, and then Senator Erickson Ropes has a question. So if we could keep our answers really short, Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Doctor. You mentioned earlier in your testimony that the guidelines that were established don't supplant clinical judgment by that. I take that to mean that whatever the guidelines say don't necessarily take the place of what physicians who are dealing with a patient may decide to do. And that's a little bit contradictory to some earlier testimony where we heard that these do restrict doctors from doing things that may be inconsistent with the guidelines. Your testimony is that guidelines are not meant to be strict and must be followed in every case, but they are the guidelines. And my question is that, and it's maybe similar to what Senator Dahl was saying, the bill itself says that the board can't take action based on a physician who determines, I assume with their judgment, clinical judgment, that doing this therapy would be beneficial to a patient. Is that your understanding, that if that were to happen, would it be appropriate for the Board of Medical Practice, even if they had a complaint, to say, well, that's okay because the guidelines don't preclude that judgment? Do you follow what I'm getting at? I mean, is the bill, in a sense, giving permission for what already is allowed to happen?
Dr. Bakken.
For a small number of patients, I think that what you're saying is true. What we're seeing growing up around the country are Lyme disease treatment clinics that are run not by infectious disease physicians, that by training at least has most experience dealing with live microorganisms and antibiotic agents, but rather by psychiatrists, by obstetricians, by surgeons, also by family practice physicians who, of course, have lots of training in daily antibiotic use, but may not have the specialty training of a complicated illness like Lyme disease. But for the vast majority of patients, I think the guidelines will serve patients well, but it's not 100% inclusive. That's what the guidelines or the statement in the beginning of the guidelines clearly outline.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Bakken. I just want to make a couple comments. I agree with Senator Dahl and Senator Hahn's point as well. It sort of gets me back to one of the first questions I asked, and I think Senator Hahn was going there, in that we seem to be at an intersection between having not gathered sufficient clinical and scientific evidence, in your opinion, and on the other hand, we certainly have a population of people that are experiencing some problems that need additional or a different approach to treatment, whether it's whatever you want to call it, whether it's a post-Lyme disease or whether it's a continuing chronic Lyme disease, whatever you want to call it, they're suffering. They need some intervention. And I just want to respond as a nurse to one thing I heard you say earlier, and you know, making a distinction between subjective and objective evidence. And the nursing process teaches us to take both of them into account. And nurses listen to patient complaints and how they describe the symptoms they're feeling. And all of that, we take all that information down. Then we also gather the objective data. We do their, you know, vital signs and so on, their history. The fact is you need both of them. And so there needs to be a way to address this population of people who seem to have special needs beyond the traditional clinical evidence-based recommendations. So I would rather err on the side of the patients and making sure that they have the flexibility or their doctors are given the flexibility to practice their art and science and craft to the best of their professional judgment rather than putting patients at long-term at risk of long-term suffering and further deterioration. We only need to back up just a little bit in terms of medical history to understand there has been a lot of centuries worth of patients describing psychiatric history, psychiatric symptoms where they were dismissed and nobody paid attention to them, female complaints, even into this last decade or last generation, you know, sometimes dismissed. People, we're still discovering more and more and more. We don't have evidence yet, maybe, to run all of these, to document all the symptoms, but they're there. We're learning things every day about symptoms that patients talk about. We don't know why they're having them. Now we're finding they're gluten-based allergies. They're lactose-based allergies. So I think we really need to listen to a large group of people that are suffering and give them and give their doctors permission to move forward, unless, as I asked at the beginning, is there a way that the board would commit to not prosecuting and punishing doctors in the state of Minnesota for treating Lyme's disease or whatever we want to call this crisis?
Mr. Renner, we're going to hear from you now. Well, I've got 4 minutes left. Mr. Renner wants to. Mr. Renner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner, here on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association, but also on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, which represents the largest specialty society throughout the state. And both organizations have reviewed the bill. As a matter of fact, the MAFP also met with Dr. Maloney, had a very good discussion, and both have taken positions in opposition to the legislation. I want to make it very clear, as most of you know, I'm not a clinician. I'm not here to debate what the appropriate treatment of Lyme disease is or isn't. But our biggest concern is the bad precedent this legislation creates. You've heard all afternoon the debate between medicine. Many who believe that there is not good science to show that this is an appropriate treatment, others who are saying that, wait, I've got patients for which it is shown promise. And the supporters of the legislation are arguing because of that disagreement. They believe this legislation is important because they're worried that the Board of Medical Practice will take sides against one side or the other, and they believe that's why we need to pass this bill. I'm here to argue that that's the exact reason why we should not pass this bill. First, as been, I think, stated a few times already, there are no cases in Minnesota where the Board of Medical Practice has taken action against a physician for this type of treatment. I'm not aware that they have any intent to do so. They are a complaint-based organization. Matter of fact, you all usually commend them for the work they do, and you want them to take more action against physicians. We find it very, very interesting that we're here arguing not to limit the Board of Medical Practices activities, but we do have real concern that you are setting a precedent when you start saying, Board, you cannot take action against an area for which there is not agreement within medicine, within science. Secondly, again, just related, the Board of Medical Practice is the group that you all have authorized to investigate complaints, to review the science, determine from the physician's personal records whether they are practicing within the standard of care. Senator Marty has argued he doesn't believe this bill defines a standard of care. I would disagree with that and argue that if you are starting to limit areas for which they can take action, you are starting to define what is appropriate care or inappropriate care, again, at a time when science is not in agreement there. And third and most importantly, as I said earlier, this does create a very bad precedent for the legislature to go down. We respectfully submit that we don't believe the legislature is the place to debate what the appropriate medical treatment and what the scientific evidence is. If we start down that path, we are worried where it will end. What happens next year, another group that feels very passionate about a certain type of treatment for another condition, whether it be cancer, whether it be autism, whether it be other conditions, for which, again, there's not complete evidence on what the efficacy is, but yet they come here and ask the legislature to, again, limit the Board of Medical Practice or other regulatory actions that may be taken. The temptations to allow access to care for which there is conflicting scientific evidence is understandable, but providing legal protection for such direction, we think, is a very dangerous direction to go. I thank you for your time. I'd be happy to try to answer questions with the big caveat, as I've said earlier, that I am not a clinician.
We've got 2 minutes left. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Renner, I am sympathetic to the testimony that you have just given. Mr. Renner, is it true that Minnesotans who are seeking care for chronic Lyme are unable to find physicians in Minnesota to treat them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I can't speak to those cases directly. I can tell you there may be, and I'm guessing there are, a number of physicians that may not treat with chronic or with ongoing therapy, antibiotic therapy. But I can't tell you that's because they're fearful of the Board of Medical Practice or not, because there's no evidence that the Board of Medical Practice is out aggressively looking for those cases. I think what physicians do is what I think Senator Erickson Ropes was talking about. They look at the evidence. They also try to look at the case, each individual case. And in this case, one piece of evidence they look at are guidelines. Guidelines very clearly are not standards of care. Guidelines are intended to be guidelines only. As a matter of fact, most guidelines are developed based on the best evidence that we can find. And to be honest, you, the legislature, have been instructing us to try to develop more of those guidelines. You want us to be evidence-based. We are trying to be evidence-based. But a guideline is just that. It is a guideline, and if there are situations where it makes sense to deviate from the guideline, then that should be pursued.
Senator Marty, you've got a bill before this committee. What's your preference?
Mr. Chairman, I will move the bill, but I want to respond to a couple of things quickly. First of all, in terms of the fact that there are risks from long-term antibiotic use, I agree. And in terms of the societal issue, I've got a bill I've got out there that would address some of the overuse. Three-quarters of the antibiotics we use in this state are on animals, not for therapeutic purposes at all, but for growth. And I think we should be restricting that and should be protecting that. Dr. Bakken earlier said that, this could, if they make this bad judgment and decide it might be Lyme disease, they'll cover up other things. We have a young man here who was diagnosed he had Lyme disease at age 15, and it wasn't until he was in his 30s that he started giving him the long-term antibiotic. This is not a covering up other things. It's a question they're not getting the chance to get the treatment they need. And again, I'm not saying that, I think what Mr. Renner was saying was that, well, we don't want to be protecting physicians for doing something bad. Well, this is not giving them any protection from doing something inappropriate. It's requiring the patients the doctors to use their best, their expertise. And in terms of that, these four studies that were quoted by Dr. Bakken, as I quoted from the author, Dr. Fallon, from the one of them who's explicitly saying that one, there was improvement. It wasn't the cognitive improvement. It was the fatigue and the pain improvement. And he said that, yes, he explicitly said he would not recommend treatment as a recommendation. He's saying that individual case by case, the doctor ought to have the ability to do that. And he explicitly told the committee that in that sort of situation, he would recommend treatment. So that's the issue. I'm happy to respond to more questions. Otherwise, I'll move the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Marty, I have a constituent that was having some issues. And when they approached their physician, their family physician within a medical group, requested a test and requested the Western blot test specifically. When the result came back, they got a false... Oh, this is hard to get this all right. A false negative based on the original screening that the medical group only, did the first screen. They would only do the Lyme screen, and if that was a false negative, they wouldn't send it on. So they had to very diligently, but my point is, it was the actual medical group's policy. The constituent asked, did you send this to a Western blot? And they said, yes, we did, but in fact, they had not. So there is a medical group type of, I think, conspiracy going on. That's an opinion, but I think from talking with constituents, that's what I'm finding to be true.
Senator Dahl has a quick question.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Very quick.
Senator Marty, I'm looking at this. We're on it's a delete all, right?
That's correct. Right.
In the first bill or the version here, I saw we had a sunset on this, and that's now been removed. Is that correct?
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. When we were meeting with the Board of Medical Practice several times over the last couple of years, and we had talked with them about a sunset until there could be some massive federal study that was done on this, and I think we concluded that that wasn't in the process anytime in the near future.
And Mr. Chair, and I, and Senator Brenner-Solnit pointed out that we had a couple of things that we had done, and we only to come back 2 years later to reverse them. Wouldn't it be more appropriate maybe to have a sunset on this so that then we'd have to revisit it to say whether we want it to continue and give it a period of window that says here's when we're going to look and see if this is making any sense or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty. I think we should give it more than a couple years. I think our sunset was like 6-7 years down, and I think that'd be appropriate. I think that way we don't – it would have to come before us again, and I think that the science is developing, so I think that's reasonable if you want
and
to propose.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, I don't know what length of time that since you've been looking at this was appropriate as far as time-wise, but I'd move an amendment that puts in a certain time frame in here. But I don't know if that's 5 years
or
3 years.
I'll suggest 6 years, but I don't know if there's any magic to that number. Okay. 5 years is fine.
Is this Senator, July 1st, Mr. Chair, is it July 1st, 2015 an appropriate date to use as a sunset?
Senator Dahl moves an oral amendment to place a sunset date.
Mr. Chair, may I help?
Yeah, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I think what Senator Dahl would like to do is insert the sunset provision that was in the original bill. Is that correct,
well,
Senator Dahl?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I don't know if we need to have the other half of it that says the passage of the federal legislation, says or whichever is later, because, I mean, we don't know if anything is going to happen. I think we should just independently have a sunset on it to revisit it and make a decision at that point.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, so all you would want to say is this section expires July 15th, 2010?
July 1st, 2015, correct.
There.
Everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Dahl's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we have Senator Marty, you want to make a motion?
I'll move the bill as amended, yes.
Okay. Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1631 as amended be recommended to pass and would be sent where, Marty? Senator Marty?
This one goes to the floor, Katie?
Floor.
Would be sent to the Senate floor. Before that, Senator Lynch. Okay. Everybody understand the motion? Okay. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Division
has been asked for. All those in favor of the passage of this motion, raise your hand.
Five, six,
one, two, three. Okay. Those opposed? Motion does prevail. Any other business to come before the committee? If not, the committee stands adjourned.
Sure, it's the right thing to do, but that's what we did.
I voted against it. I just don't see that it does the things.
I think when we talk about the
fun being chair.
Because I don't think it's. I think what you're saying is pretty similar with made me pay attention.
Yeah, that's true. That's welcome back, buddy.
Well, I